5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A day after releasing a statement announcing it was disbanding the Libyan Islamist government in Tripoli, reverse course, with the Prime Minister of the National Salvation Government urging his ministers to remain at their posts and not cede authority to a UN-backed unity government. The reason for the change is unclear, but may reflect a division within the ranks of the Tripoli regime. Zubair Iqbal is a resident scholar with the Washington-based Middle East Institute.
It's quite clear that some of the militias who were supporting the Salvation Government did not like the idea of folding up and accepting the UN-supported government, the management, Siraj management. And they're a fairly strong militia because they're the ones who provide protection to the movement of oil, crude oil, that Tripoli government sells.
The Tripoli-based authorities Tuesday said they were disbanding to cede authority to the unity government. The UN-backed Government of National Accord, headed by Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, arrived at a Tripoli naval base last week. Libya has been in chaos since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed in 2011. Rival armed factions have spent the last 5 years trying to grab power and take control of Libya's lucrative oil industry. The Syrian army and its allies have launched a major counterattack on the village of Tel al-Ais, south of Aleppo, overrun earlier this week by al-Qaeda-linked rebels. The Syrian ground offensive is said to be backed by heavy and concentrated airstrikes. Pro-government forces have been bolstered by recent battlefield gains, including the recapture of the ancient city Palmyra from Islamic State fighters. The al-Qaeda affiliate, the Nusra Front, and the IS group are not covered by the country's cessation of hostilities, which went into effect 6 weeks ago. Proximity peace talks are set to resume in Geneva on Monday. This is VOA News. A majority of the Dutch who voted in Wednesday's referendum rejected a European Union trade deal with Ukraine by about a 2-to-1 margin. Dutch Foreign Minister Bert Koenders said it means ratification can't move forward at this time.
So we have to take a step-by-step approach. We have now to talk within the cabinet, with the parliament, with our European partners, also with the Ukraine, to see what the consequences of this decision might be.
The referendum, which is non-binding, comes just 3 months before British voters are to cast ballots on whether to remain in the European Union. A day after Iceland's prime minister resigned amid a public uproar over his wife's involvement in an offshore account holding millions in debt from failed Icelandic banks, the government named a new prime minister, calling for new elections later this year. Arni Paul Arnason is an opposition leader.
Well, I think the Icelandic public can be proud to have, with the assistance of the international and domestic media, put such a pressure upon the government. The prime minister is out, and we will be forcing an early election. We would have wanted to see that election immediately. I think more needs to be done in order to re-establish credibility for the Icelandic political system.
Prime Minister Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson quit just days after the so-called Panama Papers were made public following a leak to a journalist consortium. The coalition government has named the agriculture minister Sigurdur Ingi Johansson as interim prime minister. The UN peacekeeping chief told the Security Council Wednesday there's been an upsurge in fighting in Sudan's Rest of Darfur region. Hervé Ladsou said the fighting pits government forces against rebels of the Sudan Liberation Army in the Jebel Mara region.
The escalation of fighting in Jebel Mara has led to large-scale displacement, especially from mid-January to late March. The humanitarian organizations estimate that as at the 31st of March, at least 138,000 people from Jebel Mara have been newly displaced, both in north, central, and south Darfur.
Ladsou says many of those have sought refuge at camps operated by the joint UN-African Union mission. A senior U.S. military official says the U.S. military could open another fire base to support Iraqi security forces working to isolate the IS-held city of Mosul. Rear Admiral Andrew Lewis's comment to reporters at the Pentagon follows last month's revelation of the existence of a U.S.-operated fire base following an Islamic State attack that killed a U.S. Marine. Human Rights Watch says millions of Bangladeshis continue drinking water contaminated with arsenic despite efforts to dig new wells at safer depths. The rights group blames nepotism and neglect by government officials. And Angola has asked the International Monetary Fund for help in extending a 3-year loan to cope with the sharp decline in global oil prices. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar will arrive in Juba on April 18th instead of April 12th, as previously announced.
I can actually officially confirm to you and to the world and to the people of Africa and South Sudan in particular that Dr. Riek Machar Teny, who is the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan, will be arriving on the 18th of April.
Ezekiel Logat-Kuof is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. Libya's parliament in Tobruk has again postponed the approval of a new unity government. We'll look at the political implications of the ICC's decision not to prosecute Kenya's deputy president. And a political pressure group demands a cleanup of Ghana's voters list.
The purpose was to drum in the need for the Electoral Commission of Ghana to deliver a credible, clean voters register through a validation process the Electoral Commission recommended.
David Asante is the leader of the Let My Vote Count Alliance of Ghana. A Zimbabwe peace watchdog group condemns escalating violence in the ruling ZANU-PF party, and a new car services in Abidjan inspired by Uber. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebels say their leader, Dr. Riek Machar, will arrive in Juba on April 18th, contrary to earlier announcement by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, JMEC, that Dr. Machar, who is the first vice president designate, will arrive on April 12th. According to the timetable announced by the JMEC, the Transitional Government of National Unity was to be inaugurated on April 14th, but in an April 6th letter sent to JMEC, chairperson and former Botswana president Festus Mohai, Machar said the April 12th date would not be workable. Ezekiel Logat-Kuof, Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, says the April 12th date was never a mutual decision. He said the rebels are appealing to JMEC to move the launching of the Transitional Government of National Unity to another date.
I can actually officially confirm to you and to the world and to the people of Africa and South Sudan in particular that Dr. Riek Machar Teny, who is the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan, will be arriving on the 18th of April 2016. He will be landing in Juba in the early morning of April 18, 2016. We will be leaving from Bagak, South Sudan, to Juba.
Ezekiel, how does this square up? There was a tentative schedule released by JMEC. It indicated that Dr. Machar was supposed to get to Juba on April 12th. What is the discrepancy?
The 12th of April that they have proposed, we have not discussed it with them, the JMEC, and they did not also consult with us. I think they just came up with this date. Yes, we understand that it is very important for us to go to Juba quickly so that the Transitional Government of National Unity is formed. And then we start the work of delivering the services to the people of South Sudan. However, now, if you can recall, we have been traveling, myself and Dr. Machar. We have been actually touring the continent to mobilize support for peace to be implemented. As we speak now, we have not yet reached our headquarters, Bagak. So we will be arriving Bagak on Sunday, which is the 10th, and then we will be starting preparing to go to Juba, starting from the 11th until the 17th, and then on 18th, we will be in Juba. You know, if you are leaving from your house, it is not easy to just move. You have to pack. You have to also prepare yourself so that you move to the next place.
I was talking to you a while ago about the tentative schedule. According to that, the Transitional Government of National Unity was supposed to be inaugurated on the 14th of April. So does this mean that this inauguration day is going to be moved forward or backward?
Well, this is actually our hope. 12th April, it is too soon for us to make it. We are speaking today, it is the 7th of April. And it is going to be very difficult for us to make it to Juba in 5 days. So definitely we are appealing to JMAC to move the launching of the transitional government of national unity to another date. And we are also appealing to the people of South Sudan to bear with us. 12th of April and 18th of April is just only 6 days. So we will make it.
I know that your troops have been arriving, or some of them, into Juba. Are you satisfied with the security arrangement for the coming of your leader?
We are actually happy. Don't forget that this is the first phase. As of today, we have 850 soldiers who are in Juba. We were supposed to have 1,370. What we are getting is that the transportation of the troops will be completed by Friday or Saturday. And then on Sunday the 10th, the organic weapons, heavy weapons, will be transported to Juba. So the second phase will be actually launched. They will start to come. But when the first phase is in Juba, like now, it is going to be there, complete in Juba on the 10th of April, my leader, Dr. Machar, will definitely be in Juba.
Ezekiel Logatkov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. You're speaking with me from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Arab media are reporting Libya's unrecognized government in Tripoli has formally stepped down in favor of the new unity government of Prime Minister-designate Fayez al-Sarraj. But the internationally recognized parliament in Tobruk failed this week to reach a quorum to vote to approve the new cabinet. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
أكد مقرر مجلس النواب صالح قلمة تأجيل جلسة الثلاثاء لعدم اكتمال النصاب القانوني.
Libyan TV reports the country's internationally recognized parliament, the House of Representatives based in Tobruk, once again postponed its approval of the country's UN-mediated national unity government, despite moves by the rival government and parliament in Tripoli to cede power to it. The television channel announced the new government's Council of State met in Tripoli and elected Abdulrahman Sawahli to be its head. It also reported Libya's central bank has been instructed to stop paying institutions that do not take orders from the new administration. A key member of the parliament in Tobruk, Abu Bakr Baira, told Arab media the new Council of State has not been legally approved and warned Prime Minister-designate Fayez al-Sarraj's new unity government must be approved by parliament in order to be lawful. Al Arabiya TV reported the Tobruk parliament was unable to obtain a quorum to vote on Sarraj's cabinet. It said it was the ninth bid to hold a session to approve the new government. Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala has told Arab media that his body agrees to the new government, but not to all the ministers that have been proposed to be a part of it. The unrecognized government in Tripoli and the General National Congress, a rival Tripoli-based parliament, officially ceded power to the new government this week. But a faction in the Tripoli parliament opposed the move. UN Libya envoy Martin Kobler stated in a tweet Wednesday he welcomes the convening of the country's new state council in Tripoli, calling it an important step. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 7th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. A political pressure group, Let My Vote Count Alliance, has petitioned the Electoral Commission of Ghana to clean up the voters' list for the November 7th general elections. This came after the group Wednesday teamed up with other civil society and opposition groups to protest in the Ashanti regional capital of Kumasi. Ghana's Electoral Commission says it will not be compiling a new voter list for the November polls, despite calls by the main opposition New Patriotic Party to do so. David Asante, leader of the Let My Vote Count Alliance, tells reporter Peter Clotty that his group plans to demonstrate across the country to pressure the Electoral Commission to compile a credible voter list.
Members of the pressure group Let My Vote Count Alliance converged in Asante region together with other pressure groups and all the political parties in the region. We came together to stage a massive demonstration. The purpose was to drum in the need for the Electoral Commission of Ghana to deliver a credible clean voters register through a validation process the Electoral Commission Committee recommended for us to have a free, fair, open and transparent election, which we believe will guarantee all of our peace after the election. It was that simple.
Some people have expressed concern that you are disrupting business activities, particularly when the Electoral Commission has come to a conclusion following a recommendation by a panel put together that it will not be necessary to compile a new voter register list in the run-up to the election. So what do you think are the prospects of this move to demand the Electoral Commission to clean up the register ahead of the vote? And do you think that could happen?
It must happen because the Electoral Commission put together a panel of experts. And after the committee finished their work, their recommendation was the electoral register is incredibly flawed because it has widespread irregularities and not fit for purpose. And the EC upheld it. For the Electoral Commission of Ghana to do a U-turn and say the commission will not do the cleaning, the commission will not do a new register, just necessitated the street agitation today. And it's not going to end here. And we believe it is better for us to speak up today than to watch the nation eventually sink along the line because of post-election violence.
There is a school of thought among some political parties that if indeed the register which has been used in previous election is deeply flawed, that means since 1992, when Ghana returned to constitutional rule, all elections that have been held are null and void and fictitious then. What do you say to that?
I disagree. Our electoral processes have evolved with time. We have had the opportunity to go through a series of processes to advance our electoral system and the election management in Ghana.
So from the demonstrations that you've held so far, what is your next line of action, particularly when the Electoral Commission is compiling a limited some sort of registration that has been ongoing for some time now? What is next for your group?
Our next line of action will be to replicate this particular legitimate street agitation in all the regional capitals. We will determine where next or which of the regional capitals we would settle for in our next action.
David Asante is the leader of the Let My Vote Count Alliance. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Ghana's Ashanti regional capital of Kumasi. The International Criminal Court on Tuesday dismissed charges against Kenya's deputy president and a local radio director for their alleged roles in the 2007-2008 post-election violence. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the ruling could have profound political implications as Kenya heads to the polls next year.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Kenya's Rift Valley region to celebrate after the International Criminal Court ruled to vacate charges against Deputy President William Ruto. Colonel Mwema is the Secretary General of New Ford Kenya, one of the political parties in the ruling Jubilee coalition.
It bolsters him politically very seriously, both nationally and in his backyard in Rift Valley, because now he will be able to act more freely, more forcefully, and make decisions without looking over his shoulder.
Kenyan political writer Barack Muluka says if Ruto runs for president in 2017, the country may not have a clear winner. The election could pit him against President Uhuru Kenyatta, potentially reigniting communal rivalries that led to the violence after the 2007 election.
If he calculates and he has got that popular following within Rift Valley, he could also say to himself, why should I be deputy president when I could be president? And of course, he would throw the game wide open.
In 2007, Kenyatta and Ruto were on opposite sides. More than 1,100 people were killed and 600,000 displaced in the violence that followed the 2007 election. The ICC charged Kenyatta, Ruto and a Kenyan radio director with crimes against humanity for allegedly orchestrating the violence. Kenyatta and Ruto then joined forces and won the 2013 election. They painted themselves as victims of Western neo-imperialism and called on Kenyans to reject the ICC. The two men insist their Jubilee coalition has reconciled communities in the Rift Valley, site of the most intense post-election violence in 2008. But communities there have clashed for decades over land and political supremacy, and ethnic rivalries continue to underscore national politics. Some accuse the current administration of favouring Kenyatta and Ruto's tribes, the Kikuyu and Kalenjin, something the government denies. Muluka says the ICC ruling this week sends a message there is no accountability.
People who are not satisfied will believe that at home there's no authority that can deal with you. On the international circuit, there's nobody who can deal with you. It's a repeat of violence. It's very likely. We've seen violence in Kakamega. We have seen the way people have been behaving in parliament. And all these are indicators that violence is very, very possible.
Kenya's Attorney General Githu Muigai said Tuesday the government will put in place mechanism to prosecute perpetrators of political violence. But critics say justice will be hampered by the same kind of political meddling and witness intimidation that, according to rights activists, led the ICC to dismiss its cases against Kenyatta and Ruto for lack of evidence. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Zimbabwean peace watchdog group on Wednesday condemned violence that it said was escalating between rival factions in the ruling ZANU-PF party as members just told to succeed President Robert Mugabe. In a statement, the Zimbabwe Peace Project called on ZANU-PF leaders to demonstrate commitment to peace and rein in the inter-party factional fights. It cited a shadowy terror group calling itself Al-Shabaab, saying it was harassing party members in Midlands province who traveled to Harare last week to welcome President Mugabe from his visit to Japan.
We have been quite concerned about the factional fights that are happening, and we are saying to leaders of political parties, and in this instance, we are specifically saying to ZANU-PF, they need to rein in their supporters. And I think as an organization, what we are recognizing is that there is a violation of people's rights, because people have the right and the freedom to associate with whoever they want to associate with. And if people had traveled to Harare because they wanted to be part of a process in Harare, there was no need for anyone else to want to violate their rights and then physically attack them.
You are also citing this group calling itself Al-Shabaab in Kwekwe. Which faction, if any, does it identify itself with?
We are not really concerned about whoever is the faction leader, but we are saying that they need to do away with violence. Allow people to be able to choose what they want. It is the violence that is coming out of all this that is of concern to us.
How widespread is this violence? Is it confined to Kwekwe or it's becoming a national problem?
This is a problem that is growing in most parts of the country. And if you look at our report in the last few months, we have spoken a lot about how intra-party conflict is growing. And I think this is a cancer that needs to be nipped in the bud.
That interview by reporter Untungamile Nkomo of VOA's Zimbabwe program. Uber, the US-based online taxi company, operates a mobile app that allows consumers with smartphones to book a cab service from Uber drivers who use their own cars. As the company makes inroads in Africa, entrepreneurs in Ivory Coast are trying to stay one step ahead. Emily Yop reports from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan, where at least four Uber-like car services have launched since last year.
Abidjan's distinctive orange taxis have been zigzagging through traffic here for decades. But recently, new competition has rolled onto the streets. In front of his house, TV producer Jean-Louis Zaibo hops into the unmarked car he ordered as the driver closes the door behind him. TaxiJet sent him the detail of the car and the driver by text message on his cell phone.
Dans le cadre de mes activités, j'ai beaucoup de choses. C'est pas évident que je retrouve cela.
Zaibo says he often carries a lot of things with him because of his work. If I forget it in a regular taxi, it's unlikely I'll get it back. And I insist on punctuality. It is paramount to me, he adds. At the headquarters of TaxiJet, all cars are tracked at all times. The service, which launched last June, now receives about 100 bookings a day. Most of TaxiJet's 500 drivers use their own traditional orange taxis, but the company has begun to expand its own fleet of unmarked vehicles to meet demand. Inspired by the American booking service Uber, TaxiJet co-founder Parfait Ouattara believes some Ivorians are ready to pay a bit more for better service.
TaxiJet est né d'une idée
The concept of TaxiJet is to provide comfortable and safe transportation for Ivorians, Ouattara says. Our drivers are qualified, they drive peacefully and are polite. Over the past year and a half, three other transportation companies have made similar bets in Abidjan, proposing various rates and levels of luxury. Taking one of these services unmarked cars costs an average of 50% more than hailing a traditional orange taxi. Entrepreneur Vang Sigoma launched his AfriCab service in Abidjan earlier this year.
Disponible à bord de nos véhicules, nous avons nos tablettes numériques.
Goma explains that in our taxis we have electronic tablets on which you can check emails and city guide. There is also a 4G network available on board. AfriCab targets all kinds of customers, but the people most likely to use the service are the middle class. And it is working. AfriCab has already had to double its fleet, and the company now has a partnership with a big hotel. So what does this mean for the city's thousands of orange taxis? Drissa Diaby of the local taxi union says they're trying to improve service. Some taxis now have GPS trackers. Others are fixing their meters, although many drivers still prefer to negotiate rates. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with football. Ghana upstaged their hosts Tunisia 2-1 in Ouad El Lille at the start of the second round in the 2016 African Women's Cup of Nations qualifiers on Wednesday. Zimbabwe edged visitors Zambia 1-0 in Harare, while Equatorial Guinea held their hosts Mali to a 1-1 draw in Bamako. Today, Thursday, Egypt hosts Ivory Coast in Alexandria. Elsewhere, Frenchman Claude Leroy takes charge as coach of Togo, the Togo Football Federation revealed in Lomé on Wednesday. He replaces Belgium's Tom Saint-Fiat. Leroy's main task is to put to good use his 30-year experience in African football to revive Togo's dream of playing in the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Togo is third in their Group A Nations Cup qualifiers behind Liberia and Tunisia. A mere 2 points separate three teams with two matches left to conclude their qualifiers. Meanwhile, FIFA Ethics Committee member Juan Pedro Damiani of Uruguay has resigned, FIFA confirmed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday. According to documents from Panama, now referred to as the Panama Papers, Damiani's law firm has business links with former FIFA Vice President Eugene Figueiredo. Figueiredo was among those arrested in a Dawn Hotel raid in Zurich last year and is among 41 key suspects under investigation for massive FIFA corruption by the United States Department of Justice. Damiani's firm is also linked to a company based in Nevada State in the United States of America with ties to business executives Hugo and Mariano Ginkis, currently under house arrest in Argentina. They are alleged to have been involved in bribes and kickbacks worth millions of US dollars, which is also under investigation by the United States Department of Justice. Finally, in boxing, Tunisia's Moez Fahima dethroned Burkina Faso's Patrice Tokusow with a unanimous point verdict to claim the Africa Boxing Union middleweight title in Msakni in Tunisia. At the same venue, Tunisia's Mohamed Kalai beat Moroccan African heavyweight champion Mustafa Ben Hizet. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.